We're examining President Trump's foreign policy legacy here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The president's pursuit to show our country's strength, that America First agenda, resulted in international isolation after 4 years. The administration has pulled out of a number of international treaties and agreements. So will the U.S. revive its participation on the world stage in the Biden administration? Will we rejoin agreements where we sever ties, the Paris Climate Accord, the Iranian nuclear deal? What will relations be like? What do you want? We're at 800-642-1234. Daniel Franklin is diplomatic editor at The Economist. He's been writing about how we need to invest more in diplomacy and in our State Department. Daniel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Well, nations around the world had different reactions to Biden's win. The Kremlin has stayed silent. A foreign ministry spokesman for China waited until November 13th and said, "We respect the choice of the American people." Can we read anything into reaction from world leaders on the election and our relationships as they stand in the world and as we move forward?
Yes, I think you can. I think you've certainly seen a difference between the reactions among Americans' allies in Europe, especially, but also in Asia, welcoming Mr. Biden and acknowledging the election results, and a much more cautious response from some of the more authoritarian leaders. At least China has acknowledged the result, but the silence from Russia, I think, is quite eloquent.
Quite eloquent. What do you see there out of Russia and its non-reaction so far, or certainly not saying a thing?
Well, I think it's wary of President-elect Biden. Mr. Biden actually has said only recently that he regards Russia as the main threat to the main strategic threat to America. China is an economic competitor, an economic rival, in his view, and I think Putin has enjoyed quite a supportive relationship to Donald Trump. Even though it has to be said that during the Trump presidency, the NATO alliance has beefed up considerably and deployed more forces, even up to the borders with the front lines with Russia. So what's happened on the ground is somewhat different from the impression that one sometimes had of a NATO and alliance in trouble. It's actually been strengthened considerably in recent years.
President Trump pushed the America First agenda in his presidency, called himself a nationalist in 2018, accused globalists as putting other nations' interests ahead of the U.S. What will Biden face? What will the Biden administration face when it takes office in January?
Well, I think there'll be an immediate change in tone. Joe Biden is someone who says he fundamentally believes in the strength of alliances. He sees that as a force multiplier, if you like, of American power. You know, on its own, the American economy is about a quarter of the world's economy. When you combine it with its allies in Europe and Asia, it more than doubles that to perhaps about 60%. And when you have that sort of clout behind you, and if you act together in key areas, it makes other big powers like China, like Russia, sit up and pay attention much more than when you're acting on your own. So I think that is the first thing. And then there will be immediate, I think, steps to rejoin some of the treaties and some of the deals, some of the arrangements that Donald Trump left. So on day one, President-elect Biden has said that he will rejoin the Paris Agreement, for example. I think that would be a very big symbolic moment.
Talking with Daniel Franklin, diplomatic editor of The Economist, we're examining geopolitics and the U.S. role in international institutions, looking ahead in 2021. What should President-elect Biden's top priority be when it comes to foreign policy? What are you watching for out of the U.S. on the international stage? Biden has said that he will reenter the Paris Climate Accord. What do you think of that? 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Frankel joining us from Grand Marshall. Hi, Frankel.
Good morning. My question is concerning Iran. Iran wants to build nuclear weapons, and if Iran's allowed to build nuclear weapons, surely they put them in the hands of bad guys that would use them against the West. Short of war, how do we stop Iran from building nuclear weapons? God bless.
All right, Frankel, thank you. Daniel, what will be the approach to Iran and the Iran nuclear agreement?
Well, I think Frankel asked a really good question that's going to be right at the front of one of the big issues that Biden has to deal with coming in. He has said he would like to rejoin the agreement, but it's not that simple because, of course, since America left, Iran has moved out of compliance and has got closer towards actually being able to make a bomb, which is a big threat. So he will seek to persuade Iran to move back into compliance and perhaps to widen the agreement to tackle some of the shortcomings that made many people in America very wary, not just Donald Trump, very wary about supporting it in the first place. And that's going to be very tricky. It's not going to happen quickly. So I think you're going to see quite a difficult diplomatic dance there. Biden starts with one advantage, which are the big sanctions that Trump has imposed on Iran, and he can use that as leverage. So in that, and in fact, in quite a few other areas, he does have the leverage that the hard line of the Trump administration has given him if he wants to eventually come back into some sort of agreement with Iran.
John called from Menominee, couldn't stay with us, and is wondering, Daniel, if you can address the Trump administration's failure to hire U.S. ambassadors. John says there's a number of ambassadors a number of embassies that don't have U.S. ambassadors, and wonders what are the implications around the world to that.
I think it's been a real problem, and it's not just ambassadors. There's been a real hollowing out of the State Department. This is a problem that goes back actually some years, stretches back beyond the Trump administration, but it's got an awful lot worse over the past 4 years. Budgets have been squeeze, morale is desperately low, and the share of political appointees has been a sort of modern record high under the Trump administration, which is very demoralizing for the career diplomats at the State Department. This month, actually, a couple of big reports have come back suggesting a whole range of reforms that are needed to tackle what they both describe as a crisis at the State Department. One is a big project at Harvard University. The other is run by the Council of on Foreign Relations, and both suggest a big new investment, that there's a need to inject resources because diplomacy is going to matter more and more in the coming years for America, precisely to deal with big global issues, to deal with China, to deal with Russia, to deal with climate change, pandemics, and so on, and to rebalance American foreign policy, which has been over-militarized in the years, really, since 9/11.
Daniel Franklin is a diplomatic editor at The Economist. We're looking back at the Trump administration's foreign policy moves, looking ahead at geopolitical implications for the Biden administration, and getting your perspective on how the U.S. is viewed on the world stage. What should President-elect Biden's top priority be on foreign policy? What aspects of foreign policy should the incoming administration stay the course on? What should change immediately? What should the State Department look like in the Biden administration? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Daniel Franklin here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing American foreign policy and what comes next in the Biden administration. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. New York Times columnist David Brooks wrote last year, America is withdrawing from the world. The Cato Institute responded with the headline, Wrong, Trump is not an isolationist. What do you think? Is America following a nationalist agenda, or do you think we're in a global leadership position? It's 800-642-1234. Daniel Franklin is diplomatic editor at The Economist, and he's our guide. Daniel, let's look closer at China. And we saw the trade war certainly unravel during the Trump administration. How has our relationship evolved with China?
Well, I think the China relationship is perhaps the biggest contribution, lasting contribution that Trump will have made, resetting that relationship, really focusing on China as a major strategic rival of the United States, and ending, I think, a degree of wishful thinking that there had been under previous administrations, whereby it was thought that if you let China into the World Trade Organization, you increased links and connections with it, it would somehow sort of become more like us. It would come along. And in fact, that hasn't happened. The opposite has happened. China has become more authoritarian, more challenging for its neighbors and for the rest of the world. And so I think rethinking the posture of the United States, but also other countries, persuading other countries to come along to take a different view of China, that's been a huge contribution of President Trump. And it will continue, I think, into the Biden presidency, although I think the Biden presidency will have nuances to, of course, to how it approaches China, with a much more cooperative approach, bringing allies on board to confront China in various forums.
Well, looking in the area of trade in particular, President Trump declined to join the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and you say it's unlikely that Biden will join the TPP. What route do you see Biden taking on trade?
I don't think he would be keen to join the TPP straight away. Certainly, it would cost a lot of political capital and be hard to get through the Senate, especially if he doesn't control the Senate when the runoff elections have happened in Georgia. So I think that's best for the future. So I think he will seek to have a sort of mixed relationship where you cooperate where you need to, where you can. You certainly cooperate more deeply with China's neighbors, but the democratic-minded, like-minded ones to America. And that's something that already has started to happen under President Trump. We've seen the reinvigoration of what's called the Quad, America, India, Japan, and Australia. Those countries have been conducting joint military exercises. Their foreign ministers have met recently. And you can see those relationships deepening as the threat of China, the perception of the challenge from China grows all around the region.
And the Quad relationship starts to gel. Talking with Daniel Franklin, diplomatic editor of The Economist, we're looking at how the U.S. will handle international relations with a new administration and what you are watching for at 800-642-1234. Rosa is joining us from Waterford with thoughts on foreign policy. Rosa, hi.
Good morning. Well, what I see is Biden will reverse President Trump's trade policies with China. And I say this because if you Google one of Biden's speeches he made years ago, he said a rise in China is a good thing. So there you go. That's going to be our future. I know China lost millions because of President Trump's wonderful trade policy with China, and Biden will reverse that. Or I should say his puppet masters will reverse that for him.
All right, so Rosa is not, you know, sees a totally kind of different perspective here about what Biden's relationship will be with China, specifically on trade. What do you make of that?
Well, I think the big question, and I think Rosa, you know, she's right to raise the point, is what Biden do you get when he becomes president? Do you get the Biden who viewed China in a particular way when he was vice president? Do you in effect get the same policies as you had under the Obama presidency, or do you have a slightly different or rather different Biden whose views on China have changed? And I think you probably get a different Biden in the sense that the idea that the old idea that trade was just going to make China change over time has gone, and I think people, a lot of people have changed their minds who were in the Obama administration, and the line has hardened. And I do credit President Trump for pushing along that change. It was probably underway anyway, but he certainly made it much more obvious and helped to spread it. So I think you do get a different Biden from the one that you had that Rosa was quoting there from some years back.
Yeah, you know, one thing to watch, of course, out of a Biden presidency is how much it will mirror or try to restore Obama's agenda as president and how much he strays from Obama-era policies. What might we see there?
Well, I do think you will see differences. I mean, the world has changed. And yeah, as you mentioned, you know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we're not going to see America leap back into that. That was something that Obama had championed and was close to completing. China has changed. The whole sense of the importance of climate change, meanwhile, has become even more important. And I think you'll see that as a tool that the Biden administration will use to reinvigorate alliances and to reassert global leadership.
You know, there have been so many severings of treaties and agreements, Article 2s. What do you see in terms of restoring any of those agreements in particular? What are you watching for?
Well, I think the first one we mentioned was the Paris Agreement. I think that'll be back. I think the other one that will be very quickly on the Biden agenda will be the New START nuclear arms deal with Russia, which is set to expire on February the 5th, so just a couple of weeks after Biden will take office, unless the presidents decide to extend it, and they can do that up to 5 years. It doesn't need congressional approval. So that's going to be very soon on the agenda, if it hasn't already been sorted out in the lame duck period of Donald Trump. And I think Biden will definitely want to extend that probably for 5 years.
When you look at the State Department and morale, as you mentioned, being so low, not having the number of employees it needs to do its job around the world, what would be the first steps in rebuilding a U.S. State Department?
Well, the first steps are sort of rhetorical ones, where you start giving some sort of sense that diplomacy and the State Department matters, and you don't disparage America's diplomats by calling it the Deep State Department, which President Trump did, partly in jest, but partly perhaps not. And then I think it does take money and it takes structural reform. There's a lot of internal changes that need to happen at the State Department. The culture needs to change. The career structures need to change. Probably need to encourage ways of getting talent and skills back into the State Department. And there's a sense that it needs to learn a lot from, for example, the US military, which has surge capacity. There is also a possibility, some argue, there should be legislation. The last legislation for the mandate of the State Department was back in 1980 at the time of the Cold War, so perhaps a new Foreign Service Act would set the mission for the State Department for the 21st century.
Daniel, do you think nations around the world will accept the U.S. as it changes its position on foreign policy quite dramatically in some areas and maybe not so in others? You know, how do you roll with that when you're a leader of another country?
Well, if you're an ally of America, you certainly welcome the fact that America is going to be committed to alliances again. But I think there's awareness. There's bound to be awareness, a sense that, well, OK, this is all well and good, but how long will it last? In 4 years' time, could we be back to a very different America again? How can we trust you? A certain amount of trust has been lost, and it takes time and it takes effort and it takes concrete measures to regain that trust. So I think there will be, it's not just back to the same old situation as before President Trump came to power. And I think it's going to take a long time to persuade the rest of the world that America is in it for the long term in the way that it used to be.
Daniel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you.
Daniel Franklin is diplomatic editor of The Economist. We have a link to his most recent article, his reporting at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, we talk with a pair of physicians who've started a new clinic to care for COVID-19 patients who are suffering from persistent, lingering symptoms related to the virus. Are you one of those long haulers? 800-642-1234 to join in. We'll talk about the new clinic for what's known as long haulers right after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a new outpatient COVID care clinic in Oak Creek for so-called long haulers experiencing lingering symptoms of the virus. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to Harvard Health Blog, tens of thousands of Americans have a lingering illness following COVID-19. Studies of patient groups find that at least half of patients continue to have complications and symptoms 3 months after the onset of the virus, even though they're virus-free. Is this you? What symptoms persist even though you test negative? It's 800-642-1234 to join in. Dr. Aaron O'Toole is a family medicine physician, and Dr. Patricia Golden is an osteopathic physician with a family medicine practice. Both are with Ascension Medical Group Wisconsin and have created a post-acute COVID care clinic. Dr. O'Toole, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
And Dr. Golden, welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Kate. It's been 7 months, but I appreciate you having us back on the air.
Well, before we get to the clinic, how are Ascension's 24 hospitals doing in the surge, Dr. Golden?
You know, we're doing okay. You know, I would say all of our health systems in general are just experiencing the highest COVID inpatient volume since the beginning of this pandemic. While all of our sites of care have prepared surge plans to adapt to the changing needs of our community, the rate at which the virus is spreading is really deeply concerning to us. We're grateful to our caregivers who continue to serve those in need and continue to come into work every day while offering many, many personal sacrifices, just really to ensure the safety and compassionate care of those we serve. We urge the community, though, you know, just like I had said 7 months ago, that we really need to be protecting ourselves and others by wearing our masks, washing our hands, watching our distance. And now I can highly recommend that we all get our flu shots.
Yeah. You know, early this spring when we talked to you, you had led Ascension's efforts to open drive-through testing and create these dedicated respiratory clinics, expand the virtual provider office visits. Are you building from those plans as you design this outpatient COVID care clinic?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and this is one of the things that early on in the surge, I'm incredibly grateful for the partnership of Dr. O'Toole that, you know, when Ascension came to us and said, you know, we need to meet the needs of our community, him and I really started working diligently to see what we could create to keep our patients safe. We even were able to get up and running. It's called a remote monitoring program. So very similar to what Aspirus was just talking about. Back in April, we developed a remote monitoring program that our patients could actually be recovering with COVID from home while clinicians and nurses were monitoring them and helping them stay safe. And then through this entire process, Aaron and I started noticing that we were having many of our patients having continued symptoms and starting to look at nationally what opportunities were happening. And that's really where this recovery program came to fruition.
Dr. O'Toole, tell us about these patients and what symptoms that they're that they're having that just won't go away?
Yeah, so have a big cluster of symptoms, and we're really learning about this on the fly, to be frank. You know, we've only been dealing with this in the States for the last 8 months or so. And so we don't really have a whole lot of long-term outcomes to look at. But as we are getting further along into the pandemic, we're learning that patients are experiencing a handful of symptoms. Those include persistent fatigue and kind of lack of stamina, muscle aches and pains, joint aches and pains, a lot of emotional symptoms, anxiety exacerbations, depression, some PTSD type symptoms, persistent loss of taste and smell, headaches. There are kind of a whole cluster of symptoms.
Why is it that some patients barely have symptoms or are asymptomatic? Others get very sick and then fully recover. Others are these long haulers that you're really focused on here. Why is there such a wide range in how bodies react to the coronavirus?
That is one of the kind of foundational questions that is very actively being researched right now. We don't have a real clear answer for that, unfortunately. I think we have gotten much better at identifying how to test folks based on symptoms for their acute phase of illness, how to manage them in the inpatient world clearly, and how to successfully get them treated and out of the hospital with less morbidity and mortality, fortunately. But for those folks that have the virus, we are really unclear as to the who's of the people that end up making up this post-acute phase of illness. It's not clear that it's because they're overly ill to start with. It's not clear if it's just more old elderly patients or certain ethnic backgrounds. We just don't know yet.
We're talking with physicians Aaron O'Toole and Patricia Golden. They're with Ascension Medical Group Wisconsin. They've created a post-acute COVID care clinic in Oak Creek to treat patients who are experiencing these lingering symptoms related to COVID-19. They're taking your calls as well at 800-642-1234. Dr. Golden, when a patient goes to this outpatient clinic, what are some types of interventions that you're able to offer in this clinic setting?
Yeah, so it's going to be a very individualized plan. And that's, you know, one of the unique things about using a family medicine physician such as Dr. O'Toole. You know, he'll sit down with the patient, review all of, you know, their hospital course, if that was part of their illness, going through a plethora of different symptoms that they may be experiencing, and then developing individualized plans, really utilizing a comprehensive approach. We have several specialists throughout our organization that have partnered with us and are collaborating to help develop these plans.
Yeah. So when you look at the mental health piece, Dr. Golden, you know, some of these symptoms such as depression, anxiety, PTSD, what are you seeing there?
Yeah, I would say that's one of our top complaints that we are seeing lingering. There's actually even a phenomenon called that brain fog.
The fog, yeah.
Yes, the fog. And, you know, with that, that's going to be incredibly important for us to really delve into what does this mean and what is the long-term effects. And we do have a neuropsychology team that's collaborating with us. We have several mental health providers that can assist in this recovery process.
When you look at something, when a patient says, I'm in this fog, I have this brain fog, I mean, how do you even approach that in medicine? Where do you go with that?
And Aaron, I'm going to let you take that one with your experience.
Yeah,
right,
Dr.
now.
Yeah, Dr. O'Toole, go ahead.
Sure. I think the way that at least I'm approaching this, and I think this is based on kind of the developing best practices across the country, is that to kind of take an approach that I would take for any patient that came in that had some concerns about depression, anxiety, or mental fogginess, but then make sure we have a little bit of a lens of either acute hospitalization or frankly, the larger lens of all of us having some degree of anxiety, frankly, considering the amount of uncertainty out there related to the pandemic. And then using those pieces to help develop interventions for folks. So for example, a lot of people are having a lot of difficulty with sleep because of kind of mind racing about their employment or about their health or their family's health. And so trying to optimize sleep is going to be a big piece relative to controlling their some of their anxiety symptoms, and then helping with the sense of fog, because we know that sleep deprivation clearly results in a kind of poor processing speed. So that's just kind of one thing. That's not necessarily specific to COVID recovery, but obviously mm-hmm. you have to look at it through the lens of all the additional stresses that people are under right now and the unique circumstances that they're in.
Let's bring in Nancy in Ladysmith. Hi, Nancy. Oh, hi, Nancy. You're with us. Just take your time.
I'm on my way to my regular doctor. I saw my heart doctor yesterday. I had the corona positive 3 weeks ago, and I've got a cough that I can't get rid of, and I can't breathe anymore, and I have a headache. When I had the corona, I had diarrhea, no appetite. Right now, I just can't do anything anymore. I can't even hardly walk. I'm wondering what they're going to do for me.
And Dr. Golden, I'll start with you. What would you say in Nancy's situation?
Well, and I do believe that Nancy's situation, we are seeing more and more of this. And I think that is why it would be incredibly important for Nancy to be able to have some type of a comprehensive evaluation. You know, we do know that there's, you know, not only the long-term lung effects that patients are seeing, you know, 3+ weeks, months out post this, but all of the extra pulmonary issues that are going along with it. And it sounds like Nancy is exhibiting several of the symptoms that we are seeing. So, you know, utilizing an evaluation in our COVID recovery program, and then being able to pull in our experts to develop a care plan for symptoms that Nancy's experiencing is going to be critical.
Yeah, certainly on the heart side, the cardiac side, because the heart can't regenerate heart muscle. And so, you know, with scar tissue, I'm sure that's certainly a concern amid COVID. As we look at an outpatient care clinic, taking your questions about living with COVID-19 and the symptoms that persist, you can join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. We will be back with Dr. Erin O'Toole and Dr. Patricia Golden in just a moment. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with a pair of family medicine physicians from Ascension Medical Group, Wisconsin. We have Drs. Erin O'Toole and Patricia Golden. They started Ascension's outpatient COVID care clinic designed for people who have lingering illness following COVID, what are often referred to as long haulers. We heard from Saul in Stevens Point email to ask, how many of the long haulers have been previously diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome? Saul says it seems that the symptoms are identical. What do you see there, Dr. O'Toole?
It's a really good question. Unfortunately, I can't really speak to specific numbers on that because, again, we just haven't been able to assess the sheer numbers of folks that kind of meet these persistent symptom criteria. But a lot of talk in the literature and in the kind of medical community right now about some of the overlap symptoms with chronic fatigue syndrome, and trying to use the information that we have from previously treating chronic fatigue syndrome and using those ideas to move forward with these kind of risks and symptoms of COVID.
We've also had our eye on how children are handling COVID-19 when they are infected. Some early on, there were documents of children getting very sick. And what is it like now? Are there instances where children can have persistent symptoms over long term?
Another great question. Didn't have a real clear answer on that, actually. And I reached out to some of my colleagues across the country last night to see if they had been experiencing any of their pediatric patients having persistent symptoms. And they said they had not had similar syndromes, similar to what the adult population has looked like thus far. And I don't know of any literature that's been published about this in case studies or anything. So does not look, at least at this point, that that pediatric patients are suffering the same kind of syndrome. But more to come.
Yeah, Dr. Golden, what would you say there if a child is testing positive and how you start to approach that at home and keeping everyone safe?
Well, I think that, you know, first off, the data is showing that about 10% of people that have developed COVID-19, whether they were hospitalized or whether it was a mild to moderate presentation, are presenting with this long haulers syndrome. So right now, we don't have the data to support from a pediatric standpoint, but that's not to say it's something that we cannot keep, you know, close to mind. The biggest thing is when children are diagnosed with COVID at home, keeping them safe is doing all of the recommended measures, you know, trying to family members, keeping everything in the home as clean as possible, trying to distance as much as possible, keeping others away from the kids as much as possible. I know it is a very difficult when a loved one is ill, we obviously have to care for them, but we have to take the measures, you know, wearing the masks around anyone that's ill and continuing to wash our hands. So all of those measures are going to at least help reduce the risk of spread and hopefully not affect other family members.
Yeah. Let's bring in Steve now in Stevens Point. Hi, Steve.
Yes. Good morning.
Morning. What is your situation?
I was diagnosed negative of COVID. I was very sick for a couple weeks with many of the same symptoms. So my first question is it possible to be diagnosed negative and have in fact had the COVID earlier? It doesn't show up. My second question is relates to symptoms of pretty severe fatigue and lack of energy, that type of thing, which lingers for me several weeks after I was actually sick.
Dr. O'Toole, can you jump in there?
Sure. I think what Steve is describing is probably a question that's on a lot of people's minds. And this goes a little bit to kind of our testing, the types of tests we're offering and when they're being delivered. I think the going thought process for people with persistent COVID symptoms, so either the post-acute folks kind of have symptoms longer than 3 weeks or the long haulers, quote unquote, the chronic COVID for more than 12 weeks. We don't necessarily need to have a positive COVID test, but the kind of it's all contextually based on kind of the evolution of symptoms and kind of the clinical scenario that's kind of put in front of the provider. Partly it has to do with, again, the quality of the tests when they were delivered on the front end for whether or not that negative was a true negative or not. And regarding the fatigue piece, I think, we hadn't mentioned this before, but one of the major interventions for these folks that are having persistent shortness of breath, breathlessness and fatigue is some physical therapy interventions that we're utilizing from previous and other types of pathologies related to lung disease to help kind of optimize lung function, optimize breathing, yeah, and get people moving again to help regain their strength.
Dr. Golden, have we learned more about immune cells and how they fight off this infection and whether that immunity lasts and for how long?
Quite honestly, it's still a work in progress. So, you know, we're incredibly excited in the medical community to see the potential of the vaccinations coming out, and we're very excited to see the rates at which we think we can help with the 90 to 95% sensitivity rates. That being said, we're still trying to figure out how long that immunity is going to last. I will say we still have the conversation with our patients that if at some point they were diagnosed with COVID, you know, though we may not test you within 12 weeks, it's not to say that after 12 weeks, you could not be reinfected. So there's so much more to come with this virus, and having COVID recovery programs such as the one that Dr. O'Toole is leading in Oak Creek is really going to help develop research, education, that's going to help the rest of our colleagues across the country.
Yeah, we're talking with primary care physicians Patricia Golden and Aaron O'Toole. They're with Ascension Medical Group Wisconsin. They've created a post-acute COVID care clinic in Oak Creek to treat patients who are long haulers. Taking your questions at 800-642-1234. Dr. O'Toole, you know, we've heard of extreme staffing shortages in hospitals. Do you have the staffing capacity to staff a brand new clinic like this COVID care clinic?
Yeah, so what we're doing for the COVID care clinic is leveraging our experience with our respiratory clinics already. So the staff that has been working with me seeing COVID-related patients in the outpatient space already, and frankly, my normal primary care team, which is what I use for my other hat, are just helping to care for these patients as we kind of leverage them into my schedule along with my regular primary care folks. We're doing well.
Dr. Golden, I'm sure your eyes, of course, are on vaccine development. We've seen some very promising news in recent days on the vaccine front. What are you watching for?
Well, we're definitely trying to determine as healthcare systems and as, you know, public health departments, how much vaccine we're all going to be allotted. Right now, we've obviously been monitoring the safety and efficacy of the vaccinations, which looks incredibly promising. But again, this is really going to come down to where is it going to be distributed? How is it going to be distributed? And how we can partner with our communities and especially our most vulnerable populations to make sure that everyone who needs it receives it.
Yeah, so lots of logistical questions coming up. And then how to prioritize that vaccine and making sure it's going to where the priority need is.
Exactly.
Well, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us, Kate.
Yeah, thank you, Kate.
Dr. Aaron O'Toole and Dr. Patricia Golden, they're with Ascension Medical Group Wisconsin, and they have an outpatient COVID care clinic in Oak Creek. Coming up, we talk with a journalist about President Trump's legal troubles and what could happen once he leaves the White House and isn't protected by the power of the presidency. Should America move on? Should there be an investigation for criminal wrongdoing? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.